And welcome back to the Roundtable. Some lovely optimistic music as lead into our Roundtable panel. We will kill your optimism shortly. It is the Roundtable panel. And Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue today. Great panel today on a beautiful Monday morning. We have Sarah Rogerson from Albany Law School and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. World professor of computer web and cognitive sciences at RPI and director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Jim Hendler is here. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. And political consultant Libby Post is here. You've been here for a while.
Yes, I have.
Complaining about the air conditioning.
Yes, but it's nice and nice in here now.
I warmed it up for you.
Thank you, Ray.
To my own detriment.
Wonderful man. I know. If you start sweating, you can go turn it back.
That's all right. The flop sweat begins in a moment or two. Okay. And speaking of that, here's Alan Shartok. Good morning, sir.
Wait. What do you mean, speaking of flops,
sweat? Oh, I don't know.
Here's Alan Shark.
I must have been a slip of some kind, sir. How was your weekend?
Okay. Yeah, right, right.
So you're feeling well? How are you doing?
Midland to poor.
So about the same.
Hey, and Jim accused me of being an old Jewish lady talking about my surgeries, and here we go, Alan.
Well,
you take the cake.
If we'd like to kvetch for a while, we can certainly do that.
Wait.
What?
Kvetch?
Kvetch. Kvetch. Kvetch.
It's not kuh.
Yeah, all right, fine. Sorry.
We're going to get letters.
Yeah, we are. It's kvetch.
Speaking of letters.
It's challah, you know.
You can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org. You know the rules. I'm tired of recounting the rules. Keep them brief. One a day. No attachments. No abbreviations. For God's sake, proofread. Other than that, everything's fine. panel@wamc.org. All right. We have lots of news to cover here this morning. We start with suicide of Jeffrey Epstein. Details are now out. They've done the autopsy, but they're not released yet. Medical officials have performed it. They will presumably release this shortly today. Epstein's abrupt death on Saturday cut short a criminal prosecution that could have pulled back the curtain on the inner workings of a high-flying financier in connection to celebrities and politicians, though prosecutors have vowed to continue the investigation. Now, he had been on suicide watch after he was found a little over 2 weeks ago with bruising on his neck, but he was taken off of the watch at the end of July, therefore wasn't on it at the time of his death. The conspiracy theories began flying almost immediately. Who would like first today?
I mean, this isn't the time for conspiracy theories. It does seem it is unusual. It looks like the FBI is going to launch an investigation into the death itself in order to figure out what happened. But I think prosecutors keeping their eyes on sort of the wealth of information and criminal activity that is probably underlying this particular individual is where more of the focus should be. That and prison safety. I think this is an opportunity to talk about what happens on the insides of the jails that we drive by every day on our way to work without thinking. Go ahead.
Now, Sarah, you know of my immense respect for you. But when you
I feel
say,
like there's
the
a
shoe's
trick.
Going to drop in a moment. Just stand by.
However,
no. That's true. By the way, I have immense respect for her. But I have a question for you, Sarah. When you say this is not the time for conspiracy theories, what do you mean by that?
I mean, I don't think that there's often ever a good time for a good conspiracy theory unless you're just sitting down at the beach trying to read a good book to get your mind off things. I mean, it's just not helpful. You know, the point is that this individual wasn't tried and convicted, but there's a mountain of evidence that he was a pretty horrible person. That he did bad things and that there were other people that did bad things with him. Many of them are important people. And so how he died, whether or not it's a cover-up, all of that doesn't matter. What matters most is getting the information in order to hold people accountable for the horrible things that happened.
And I also think that this is a man who controlled every single part of his life and whoever's other's life he could control.
Absolutely.
And this is the last act of control if he did do it. I don't want to feed into conspiracy theories. I mean, you know, Trump tweeted this baseless idiocy over the weekend, saying that the Clintons were responsible. And then somebody else saw it on Facebook. If the Clintons were that powerful, Trump would have been taken out a while ago and Hillary would be president. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, this is a man who abused women, abused young girls,
children
for years and years and years. And he wanted the control, and he had the ultimate act of control, which is killing himself and then not being held accountable.
Well, I think that's right. I want to go back, if I can, to the concept of why it's important, if in fact powerful people were involved in this, that this happened. And that, you can call it conspiracy theory, you can call it anything, but it's astounding. They didn't have another guy in the cell. They weren't checking every half an hour. All of those things add up to something. I've heard from an awful lot of people this weekend who are quite sure that something really illicit was going on here. And I'm not counting it out, and I think it's terribly important. We had a president of the United States who stood up and said the guy was a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
There are pictures of him. Of them together, although some of them apparently are phony. There is an idea that he has said, yeah, he liked young girls or something like that, and basically attached himself to that idea. I think having heard from virtually everybody in my family and everybody else over the weekend that this is a very serious issue and really ought to be looked at.
Which is why the FBI is looking at it. I mean, I guess maybe it's an issue of semantics. If we're talking about whether or not there was additional criminal activity that led to conditions where this man was able to sort of take matters into his own hands, that's an investigation as opposed to a conspiracy theory.
I know Jim Hendler had mentioned walking in today that he has spent the weekend trying to figure out which conspiracy theory to go with.
And yeah, so, that's right.
What's your take on
that? There's hardly
the whole
any
thing?
Of them out there. Well, you know, I see a different lesson in all this. There's first of all, there's the whole continuing investigation. I think it's really important that that goes on. I don't that at all. But, you know, about the Epstein thing, you have Barr weighing in. So you have the Department of Justice coming in and saying, you know, we're going to see, we're going to get to the bottom of this. Mm-hmm. This shouldn't happen in prisons. Right. How many black poor inmates died
the
weekend in prisons in America?
How many
people who are incarcerated right now for immigration crimes that are minor infractions are living in cells where they're treated with far less debt? I mean, on one hand, I'm bothered by what this may do to the continuation of the investigation and all that. But, you know, if it can do anything, just the stuff that's coming out are things like the guards were overworked, the paperwork couldn't move in time. I mean, these are day-to-day life in these places.
The paperwork couldn't move in time. Now, you can't walk in a 7-Eleven without being under camera surveillance. You're telling me that they can't have cameras in a high-security lockup?
I'm saying,
Or didn't have cameras.
Or didn't have working cameras. I mean, again, you know, I suspect a lot's going to come out, but we're going to investigate this one because the guy was rich.
Well, right. Let's face it, Rikers has been, and this is not Rikers, of course, this is federal, but Rikers has been a cesspool for years, and we all know it. And we all know that that jail guards and others have helped at times getting illicit drugs and everything else into these places. I think there's an awful lot of smoke and therefore fire here.
So what's your somewhat premature opinion as to what happened then, Alan?
Well, why would it be premature?
Well, because no one has the facts. I'm just saying, what is your reckon?
Well, I think it is entirely possible something terrible happened here. And that, you know, in the same way Whitey Bulger got murdered in his federal prison, something happened here. Somebody was in on it. And I think that it is incumbent on all of us to make sure that the right kind of investigation, and not by Attorney General Barr, who, after all, is a tool of this president.
I mean, I think that we should be mindful that this is probably something that the Trump administration is pouncing on to distract us from the important work that we should be doing around issues like prison reform and others. If we get all ginned up and excited about, you know, this flashy figure and the money and the fame and the crimes and the this and the that, then we're not paying attention to, you know, the issues that, mm-hmm. that matter, that are going to matter into the 2020 election.
So, Sarah, what do we do? Forget about this? In other words, you say, okay, it may be a distraction, and it may well be a distraction. But the fact of the matter is, it happened. It's awful. Very powerful people, many very powerful people, have been implicated in a relationship with this guy. And I think we can do two things at once. We can investigate this, and we can pay attention to the stuff you want us to pay
Libby
attention.
Post is raising her hand. So go ahead, Libby. We call on you.
Well, I just don't want us to forget about the victims here. The women, the yes. teens, the girls who were abused by this man. And, you know, I heard somebody say alleged victims. This is not alleged anymore. We know that this stuff happened. And they need to get some closure. And I'm hoping that other criminal cases continue for the people who helped him, his colleagues who helped him. There were women involved in this as well, in the trafficking, because this is what this was. It was sex trafficking. But also that they can get some closure, whether it's seeing some of these other people go to jail or getting some type of financial remuneration so that they can get their lives back on track. I mean, we're talking about young girls, 12, 13, 14-year-old girls who were raped by this man and whose lives are just changed forever because of sexual violence. And, you know, oh, he's dead, so we won't be able to do it again. It's just not good enough. These women deserve closure, and they deserve some kind of ability to feel like they can move on with their lives.
Right. And I think Jim's point as to sort of lifting up the other unheard voices in this story, if we're going to talk about how prisons work in America,
yep.
If we're going to talk about how prisons work for rich people, then I think it makes a lot more sense to focus on how prisons work for everyday people. And we shouldn't be shocked that the camera wasn't working. We shouldn't be shocked that the guards are overworked.
We should be shocked that the camera wasn't working.
No. I mean, have any of you been in a prison? I think everybody...
Yes.
Yeah? Which one, Alan?
No, I've been in prisons. I used to take students from New Paltz and things.
Yeah.
I've been in prison. I know.
I think it's an important thing to do. I think all of us should. And, you know, once you spend, I spent a significant amount of time in the Albany County Jail last summer, and I've spent time in other prisons as well. And, you know, things don't always work exactly how they need to. Our system is really broken. And I know this is a high profile individual, so people think, well, everybody should have been laser focused on this person. Why? You know, because he's wealthy and high profile. Like, we should be elevating the issues, as I said, for everyday prison workers. Did you guys know, and I have to repeat this fact, that corrections officers suffer post-traumatic stress disorder at a rate that's higher than Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans? That's astonishing to me. And they go to work every day to participate in a system that's broken for the inmates, for the people that work there, and for us as American citizens. And if we were really paying attention to issues, we would elevate that as part of the discourse around this high profile individual.
No doubt. Nevertheless, I think in this particular case, special attention needs to be paid here. And I think it has got to be assumed that this is more than just part of a system that is broken. You know, when I worked at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and taught there, I was only there for a year. But I had students who would tell me of horrific things that the guards would do, Sarah. I'm sure mm-hmm. you're aware of this. Yep. They would form. I never knew if it was true, of course, but they would form gangs to go into prisons at night to beat up inmates who had misbehaved. And we do know the amount of contraband that comes into these prisons. I think there's a very good at least possibility here that this was more than something that was just part of the system.
All right, we need to take a quick break here for news. You can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org is the email address, and we will get to some of your letters after the break. Libby Post is here. Sarah Rogerson is here. Jim Hendler is here. Alan Shartok is here. You are there. We will be back here right after we do some news, which is coming up right after the underwriting, which you hear. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Monday morning, 9:33. Blue skies for the most part out there. Ray is in for Joe today. It's the Roundtable panel. Jim Hendler is here making funny faces. Sarah Rogerson is here. Libby Post. Alan Shartok, whose face is always funny. The email address is panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. And we have some letters here. This one is from Neil in Wendell. And he writes, Trump is leading the media around by the nose again by spreading the conspiracy that the Clintons are responsible for Epstein's death. He takes a shot at his enemies, stokes his base, and gets the media talking about his outrageous behavior. More importantly, he distracts everyone from realizing just who had the most to lose if Epstein testified and who benefits most from his death. And that is from Neil and Wendell. Anybody want to weigh in?
Exactly, right. Neil. Yep.
Spot on.
Agree.
All right. This is from Janice in Middlebury, Vermont. And let us not forget that Attorney General Barr's father was responsible for hiring Jeffrey Epstein at his highfalutin private prep school in Manhattan when he didn't even have a college degree. Barr should not be involved in this investigation. And that is from Janice in Middlebury.
Well, none of this administration should be involved in this investigation.
All right.
It's a little complicity.
This one's from Bob in Albany. I worked in New York City's jail system for 12 years and have seen many, many examples of overworked correction officers cutting corners to make their work lives a little easier. News reports today indicate that one of the two overnight shift officers had worked 5 straight days of overtime and the other had been forced to work overtime on the night Epstein died. Maybe something nefarious did happen, but the most likely explanation is that exhausted officers just messed up. Alan.
Well, that certainly is true. I mean, we have to consider that as a possibility, but I think there are a lot of other possibilities that have to be considered, too. I mean, it isn't as if Epstein was in a place where powerful and other people didn't have something to gain by his being out of it. Look, there are reports of some of the most powerful people in America having been involved in abusing these women, a terrible thing. So so I think, those are the kinds of things that people have killed for in the past, and I'm not so sure it didn't happen here.
Now, was he in a federal correction?
Yes. Federal lockup?
Yes.
It was Metropolitan Correctional Center.
Yeah, no, that's federal.
Now, I know that Sarah had mentioned working quite a bit at the Albany County Jail mm-hmm. last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still astonished that there would not be wall-to-wall camera surveillance in a federal special housing unit.
No, that's fair.
That's fair?
That's totally fair, yeah.
Should be.
The county jails is run a lot better than many of the other county jails, and they even have body cameras for all the corrections officers in a county jail. So
it just seems like there's something missing.
There does seem to be something missing.
This one came from Norm in Clifton Park, and Norm writes, a rich pervert commits suicide, and we analyze it for days. Thousands of veterans have committed suicide this year, suffering from PTSD, and we let it slide. Seems wrong.
Agree.
Yep.
This one's from Mike in Saratoga. Morning, I agree. Uh-oh. I agree with Alan, he starts. This guy had ties ranging from a member of the royal family to ex and current U.S. presidents. He was in a federal prison, which reports up to the Justice Department, which is run by the stooge of Trump, William Barr. Nothing about this makes sense, and we need an independent investigation, not one run by the fox who ran the hen house, and that is from Mike in Saratoga. He agreed with you, Alan. Do you have anything to say?
Yes, he's brilliant.
All right, sir. Then moving on.
Well, and the FBI agrees with both of you. I mean, they're doing what the FBI does. So we'll see what they're.
And hopefully they can continue to do it without any interference from from Barr and the people who run the Justice Department, because they do work for him.
And let's remember the firing of Comey and everything else. This president has not been obscure in his need to run the FBI or his attempts to run the FBI.
The news out of Hong Kong this morning, one of the world's busiest airports, canceled all flights after thousands of pro-democracy protesters crowded into the main terminal Monday afternoon in Hong Kong. Hong Kong International Airport said in a statement that the demonstration seriously disrupted airport operations. Hong Kong has experienced a couple of months now of mass protests calling for democratic reforms, independent inquiry into police conduct, with both the protesters and police adopting ever more extreme tactics. Beijing issued a statement saying the situation in Hong Kong was beginning to show the sprouts of terrorism and constituted an existential threat to the population of Hong Kong. And they went on, Hong Kong has reached an inflection point where all those who are concerned about Hong Kong's future must say no to lawbreakers and no to those engaged in violence. Somebody here on the panel before we started said this has a strange echo to a time in China not too long ago.
Yeah, this was, you know, the terrorism was part of how they started justifying what eventually went down in Tiananmen Square. Most of, I actually had a visitor from Hong Kong last week.
Yeah.
Professor there says he's hopeful at this point that it's not going there. He thinks the Chinese don't really want that kind of level of negative, especially
attention
on Hong Kong. And he thinks that the Hong Kong, that most of the people in Hong Kong are nervous about China using it as an excuse. He says his biggest worry is, you know, a few students getting out of hand. There were students who were talking about things like potentially taking over one of the police barracks, taking over one of the military things. In fact, there was a, the day after he told me that was the day they released that thing which showed the Hong Kong military or Hong Kong police, whoever it was, you know, really showed that they had guns and were nasty and please don't try to take over their barracks, because they're very well known for being very friendly with the populace. They're actually considered a very supportive force. Yeah, and and the military, and the Hong Kong military. And therefore, you know, there was a feeling that the students might push them too far. So it's really a situation that's potentially out of hand. He says that, you know, they've reached the point where the proximal causes, the things that they were actually protesting for, have mostly been either temporarily or sort of long-term put on the shelf. But the real problem is that housing is insanely expensive. So most of these people have nowhere to live. Jobs are getting harder to get, things like that. So he says, you know, here's a place where you have this very high quality of life and yet terrible income inequality, terrible problems. And these are not the kids from the poor side of the trick. These are the middle class, as we would call them.
My gosh, this all has a Western ring to it, doesn't it?
Very Western ring to it.
Well, you know, communism has a very Western ring to it. I mean, look at, you know, you look at China, and it's a very Western kind of way of life as long as you are the right person in the right party.
Well, and Hong Kong is much, much more Western.
Yeah, it's always been.
Yeah, so Hong Kong is actually has a separate, not quite a separate constitution, but a separate set.
People need to remember it was a British protectorate for years and years and years.
Go ahead, Alan.
So let's assume for a second that they don't want to do it. They don't want to, you know, crack down tenement-wise. Nevertheless, they may feel they have to preserve their rights and their system. And I suspect, you know, we would be naive to think that they won't do it if they have to, if they feel they have to.
But this sort of rings of, like, both sides-isms. It's the anniversary of the death of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, and I hope we'll get a chance to talk about what's going on with race in this country later on. But the idea that the protesters are quote unquote violent. I've been watching a lot of the videos of the tactics that the protesters are using. They aren't hurting anyone. They're responding to a ridiculous amount of force, given what they're doing, which is largely peaceful protests or occupying spaces. And we don't do a good job of talking about protest, how it works, how it moves the ball forward. Although in this case, we were talking during the break that the protesters don't have a clear set of asks. So it makes it difficult for the government to respond to the movement.
But it has been, but it is important, Sarah is right, that this has been largely a nonviolent protest. So in the mm-hmm. airport, they were carefully allowing aisles for people to get through and things like that. Now there's a question as to whether, now that the airport's been closed down, whether that was because the protesters were getting more people were coming, causing problem. It looks like part of that was that the flight attendants and flight crews were starting to support them, particularly the Cathay crews, and that China has now ordered that Cathay may no longer allow any of their employees who were involved in the strikes to come to China. And so it's kind of, you know, a tit for tat is going on. That's a very dangerous situation because you don't see an obvious ending. You do have a lot of anger there. You know, in the U.S., Occupy sort of just disappeared overnight. Mm-hmm. And
was that?
Don't know, but part of it may have simply been that there was discontent, but not a specific focus. And so the question is, does the Hong Kong protest become like that and dissipate, or does something happen that precipitates something worse happening? And he says, you know, a lot of the people in Hong Kong are getting nervous about that latter one because they just don't see an obvious endpoint that doesn't lead to escalation of some kind.
Aren't you all impressed by the fact that people are willing to risk their lives? Middle-class people are willing to risk their lives. I mean, you don't see that happening here, no matter what the provocations are. So it's an extraordinary circumstance to me.
Well, that's why I brought up Charlottesville, because uh-huh. there were a lot of people who stood up, who were students and middle class folks and people, and it wasn't just on August 12th. It had been happening for years, many years. And the student who actually raised the issue of the Confederate statue is now going to UVA and still fighting the fight that they've been battling in Charlottesville. So and that ended in violence. And then the president said that there were extreme mm-hmm. measures on both sides, and there weren't. The person who killed Heather Heyer went to jail, tried and convicted, white supremacist. So we just have to be careful about, it's very easy for the government to allege violence on the part of protesters.
We have to take a break here. Sarah Rogerson is from Albany Law School. We have Jim Hendler from RPI, political consultant, Libby Post, and Alan Chartok here. You can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Hello again. Hey, we're on the air there. Jimmy, just hang in there. It's the roundtable panel this morning. It's 9:47. The roundtable panel, they're in full flower today. Jim Hendler is here. Sarah Rogers and Libby Post. Alan Chartok. You, of course, joining the fun by emailing, and we use the term fun extremely loosely, by emailing us at panel@wamc.org.
Always fun.
You know, that's.
I mean, really.
Thank you very much.
You guys You're should welcome. See the balloons in here.
It's yeah, it's amazing. Really yeah. something. It's just, everybody's just having we're dancing on the
right?
tables.
It's 112 degrees in here. Yeah, everybody's nodding off.
I don't
off.
Know right. what room you're in. But.
This one came in from Steve in Ulster County. Subject heading, Yay Libby. Yes, let's not forget the pain, the anguish, the debilitating stress the victims still contend with years after the fact. Let's not remain silent about that, please. And that is from Steve in Ulster County.
Thank you, Steve.
This one's from Robin in Cooperstown. Something positive for prisons. I thought you might be interested to know that the Glimmerglass Festival is taking their production of Showboat to Attica Prison today. They've been doing this for a number of years. It's a moving experience for both inmates and performers. And that's from Robin.
Wow.
That's command cool. command performance.
Very cool.
This one is from Cheryl. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Get the victims closure and some kind of reparations. Go after the facilitators. Yes, prison reform is very important, but I think the victims are the most important. And that's from Cheryl.
I don't think any of us would disagree with that.
No, but they do get lost in all of this. The sideshow of a suicide. becomes the main story instead of what the real story was. Yeah.
That's right.
Here's an interesting one from John, and the subject heading, a bias shown by the panel. I'm bothered by the talk of just because he was high profile doesn't mean he deserved special treatment, because that misses the point. He could have incriminated other high profile people. Such a prisoner didn't require special handling decades ago, and here is where the panel is showing a bias toward thinking we still live in a nation run by the rule of law. We don't, not anymore. And that is from John.
I think that was a very good letter.
Money speaks, is what John's saying, I think, right?
Well, you know, I mean, I think right. It's not either or. I think Sarah's absolutely right. The prison system is a mess, and we know it, and we've known it for years. Nevertheless, there is a potential of a major crime happening here, and it ought to be investigated and not ignored.
Now, this one came in from Anne. Alan, please don't lead us down the conspiracy theory path. Let's follow the path suggested by Libby and Sarah. Conditions of prisons, overworked prison guards, general neglect, most importantly, the victims.
Okay, but once again, it's not either or. It's both. I mean, you can't put words in my mouth. You can never do that, even though...
Well, there's not room. Like to.
That's funny, Ray.
Thank you.
Really funny.
Thank you very much. This one's from Wilbur. We don't want to advance theories, but we can't help ourselves. Earlier this morning, Alan trashed Trump, advancing the theory that Clinton had something to do with Epstein's death. But then Alan went on early this morning to trying to connect Trump with Epstein's death and saying falsely that the two were best buddies. That's from Wilbur.
Facts are facts.
Wilbur's listening.
So, you know, there's a point we shouldn't lose here. And I actually thought Marco Rubio put it right, which is that all of the things doing trolling, including the Russian trolling, but let's for this, are jumping on this and mm-hmm. trying everything right. they can to use it for polarization.
But there's nothing new about that. I mean, whitewater is still a thing in some quarters, right?
Right, but the speed with which this is trying to play into not building cooperation, that something bad happened, that this was someone who did bad things, that we can all agree that molesting young girls is not a good thing. It's becoming immediately a polarizing issue, and it's Clinton versus Trump, and it's replaying the election. You know, again, this notion of whether that's requiring outside forces, as Rubio says, I think it's coming more from just how technology, how our whole social discourse is happening nowadays. But the speed with which essentially these, you know, what I would call the fake news system has jumped on this, and the ability to just grab little pieces of things, quote them out of context, but then turn that into so much more than it used to be, because it's so much easier now to get
within
one
minutes.
Group arguing with another group mm-hmm. and within just making minutes. The whole thing. And then the as everyone said, the argument becomes the story mm-hmm. rather than the story.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure it helps that when you have the president retweeting things that are maybe a little less factually based.
Maybe.
I would have to agree with that.
That are out and out lies.
I don't
like
know
it.
Why anybody but the press still follows that man on Twitter. It just it boggles my mind.
I believe our culture has reached a certain entertainment stage, which is similar to bread and circuses, mm-hmm. where people are just, Rome is burning. Party on, right?
Yeah.
Our email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Sarah Rogerson is here, Jim Hendler, Libby Post, Alan Shartok as well. Oh, the Democrats were in Iowa over the weekend, and they went to the Wingding fundraiser on the Wingding on
Everybody
Friday.
Goes to the Wingding.
That's right, and Elizabeth Warren made some, I would say, some big, not necessarily news, but there was a murmur among the following. She tweeted out, she said, trade war by tweet is not working for our farmers. She said of President Trump's using Twitter to announce tariffs on China. She also was there with Pete Buttigieg, who said he accused the president of coddling white nationalism and mocked Trump's background in TV, saying he wasn't sure if its current occupant had turned the White House into a reality show or a horror show. Amy Klobuchar was there, said, last time I had 20 minutes, this time I have 20 candidates. It was a raucous time, and then they went around eating things and at the fair, and it was interesting, I think, because a lot of the time they didn't attack each other. So this may be a turning point in this Democratic campaign, even though there's still certainly a large number of them.
Yeah, I saw Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren had a nice hug that was mm-hmm. covered. There was a lot of talk of food. Cory Booker's a vegan. What's he going to eat at the Iowa State Fair? Turns out you can fry peanut butter and jelly.
Fried peanut butter and jelly.
Oh, my God.
That's for the vegans.
Fried in what, though?
I don't know.
You see?
Did he check? Peanut oil.
Okay.
And everybody's looking for a breakout. It would appear that our junior senator, Gillibrand, is making major advances. She moved in one poll, which I suspect, from the zero group to the 2% group.
What?
That 2% group has a lot of action going on.
And I think, is that the threshold for the next one?
I think it's donations as opposed to polling
it's
numbers.
130,000.
Yeah. So it's individual. It goes by number of individual donors.
I'm sorry for having to say this, was kidding.
Was your firmly planted in your cheek?
Yeah. I'm shocked. But the thing is, there were a lot of stories over the weekend too, though, about how Cory Booker, who has been solidly in the 2 and 3%, is going to break out of that pretty quickly, given the numbers of people in attendance on his ground game events in these early primary states. He's getting an outsized amount of attention than the other candidates. I don't believe any of the polls right now.
You noticed that you said is going to, as opposed to is.
Mm.
Yeah. Me and a lot of other political pundits are making that prediction.
Speaking of someone who is not polling all that well, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper had this to say. He noted that Trump's approval rating was about 42%, just a tad lower than President Reagan and Obama before they won re-election. He said, although neither Reagan nor Obama had an economy as strong as the one today. So, Alan, he echoes what you have been saying.
I have, and believe me, I'm not alone in that. The New York Times analysis has been, for the last several months, that Trump has a very good chance of winning re-election. And if the Democrats can't get their stuff together, stuff starts with S, together, then they're going to lose. It's extraordinary to me because this guy is unbelievable that we would find ourselves in this kind of situation. But he may well win, and it depends on what the message from the Democrats is going to be. If it's far left, if it's too far out of the park, they'll lose the middle, and the middle will vote for Trump or will stay home, and that'll be the ball game.
It's the people who stay at home that elected Trump. So.
Absolutely.
Yep. Saturday, most of the Democratic candidates had things to say about guns and the NRA and Donald Trump. We mentioned Kirsten Gillibrand. She's kind of questioned the way the president was stigmatizing mental illness. And she said this, it's just President Trump lying to the American people again, being inauthentic about what the problem is, trying to distract and trying not to take responsibility for what is happening in this nation.
Yeah, I think the Democrats are finally getting to a point where they're unifying around an anti-Trump message as opposed to fighting about. Because Joe Biden said another ridiculous thing over the weekend.
Yes, he did.
And they didn't pounce on that. So I think that we're seeing a turn. Some people are seeing the writing on the wall. Some people aren't. I mean,
what's the writing on the wall?
Which is they have to unify, and they have to unify against Trump. And that has to be a message now. And they have to put their ground game in now in order to turn out voters at the polls.
But they also have to focus on issues. I mean, that's how we won in 2018. We have to focus on health care. We have to focus on bread and butter issues. We have to focus on the inequality of wealth. Yes, the stock market might be doing well, but not everybody's in the market, and not everybody is doing all that well in the market. You have to be doing, you have to be, you know, invested in certain sort of things that those of us who do invest but want to invest responsibly are not doing that well.
The Democrats.
Hey, Libs, far be it for me to disagree with you.
Here we
but
go.
But the fact is, I think it was Trump. Yes, it was health care. It became somewhat issue-oriented. But I think it was Trump. People were disgusted with him,
yes,
and they were
voting
against
him. Yes, I agree.
But
we have to, you know, give something to the mushy middle.
Sarah is shaking, and so I'm going to let her have the last word before news.
Some of the Democrats that flipped districts, some of the more moderate Democrats that aren't getting as much attention as the squad, all they did was talk about health care.
Right.
And markets.
Right.
And traffic.
All right. Yeah. That's where we will leave it before news break. You can email us by sending your mail to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have Sarah Rogerson, Jim Hendler, Libby Post, and Alan Shartok, Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We'll be back after news. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Monday morning. It's 10:06. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We have the Roundtable panel in full bloom here this morning. Jim Hendler is here, Sarah Rogerson, Libby Post, and Alan Shartok. You have been joining in by emailing us. Some more people have done just that. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Gene from New York, New York, writes, the protesters in Hong Kong do have a goal. They want to free Hong Kong from China, or at least make sure that China's continuing attempts to undermine Hong Kong's autonomy will end. But those goals are probably unattainable in light of China's intent on the opposite.
Totally agree. So it's a goal with a lack of specific demands, which is the issue.
I mean, the end game was already determined once Britain backed out, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually a fairly complicated situation because Hong Kong is a major financial sector for China and actually serves as – well, yes, but it actually serves as part of how China is able to maintain its growth because they can let Hong Kong sort of deal with the West while they deal with the East in a sense, and they can grow through Asia without losing that connection. The tariffs and things like that are putting different kind of pressures on China. So it's really a very complicated situation there. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, from our point of view, it looks very simple. I think Sarah said it right before, that these protests, you know, we tend to focus on the protests and miss that there may be some very, very complex interplay here. That said, it's hard to know what to do about it.
Right, but complex or not, in the end, if the leaders of China think that the system, their dictatorship, is at stake, they're going to do what they have to do in order to survive.
I agree, Alan. But as my Hong Kong friend put it, right, but so far this protest hasn't spread into China, outside of Hong Kong. That's when he thinks one of the lines that could get crossed.
Interesting.
This email from Daisy. Regarding qualifications for the next debate, September qualifications, it's not just donor numbers. You have to be at 2% of the polls as well. One thing we were talking about the Democratic candidates being in Iowa, and one thing many of them seem to agree on, at least Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, I think Julian Castro, all said that Walmart needs to end gun sales. And Jim, you mentioned something that I did not hear.
You hadn't heard this?
Gun sales go on.
So Walmart is taking very specific action nationally with respect to what happened. They are limiting various things in video games, and they haven't changed at all their policy on guns.
But is it not disingenuous for a candidate to say, well, I would like store X to stop selling guns, but then not make that a blanket statement covering all stores?
I agree.
Yeah, I think that it's just the rhetoric is following up on the most recent, you know, tragedy that's come about. That happened with Dick's and a couple of other stores in the last couple of rounds of mass shootings that we've had. So I think it's just the store that's implicated in this particular one.
Well, except just to be more clear, I think that in this case, many of the Democratic candidates were responding specifically to Walmart taking action that didn't involve guns. In other words, they're buying into the false equivalency
of the video game stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna take down the signage and take down the promo for the violent video games, which makes people shoot people up. Yet they're going to continue.
And there's no link.
And they don't lose any money over it because they really don't make very much money off of the video game sales. They mostly use the video game sales to sell bigger ticket items, the TVs, the controllers, et cetera. Guns, they make more money off of. So I think it's that cynicism.
Yeah, it's just buying into that false equivalency and promoting the president's, well, the Orange Menace's theory and giving it credibility.
Well, don't you think at the point at which Walmart, and I think you're saying this basically, Walmart thinks that people who don't want to go in the store because they're afraid, you know, of what's going to happen next there, or that would be the cause to change their policy on guns?
I think a lot of the people who shop there are people that support the right.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that really works moving forward. And I you know, when it comes to Walmart and any other gun store, I drove through New Hampshire over the weekend, and there were a lot of guns and ammo stores that had their doors wide open for business, promos going on because gun sales surge after every incident of mass violence in this country.
That's true.
Because people are afraid that they'll be taken away and they want to stockpile. So Walmart is making a business decision because why would they cut sales at exactly the right time for them to make a ton of money off of the fear that is being stoked by the Democrats who say they want reasonable gun control,
but they're trying to look responsible.
Now, what is reasonable gun control? I hear sensible gun control and I hear reasonable gun control. They seem to be buzzwords.
Taking the weapons of war out of the hands of civilians.
Is that what it means?
Because
everyone
background checks.
Sensible seems to be the buzzword.
Yeah, universal background checks. All the things that are polling well. All the things that people in Walmart would vote for are the things that people
are saying
are sensible. But they
wouldn't vote for. They wouldn't necessarily vote for taking weapons of war out of the hands of civilians. People want their AK-47s.
They
want their AR-15s. They want to be able to have those weapons for whatever reason.
Because it's a slippery slope argument,
right?
I guess my question is why any candidate would feel that it's all right to say, well, I think that the big box store should stop selling guns when it's legal to sell guns and maybe they want to change that, but if it's legal to sell guns and you have the right to sell guns, then
as corporate America goes, so goes our culture. And so if Dick's has stopped selling guns and is making a statement, and Walmart were to stop selling guns and making the statement, and then maybe Cabela's and the other folks.
Never Cabela's.
Yeah, well, you know, whatever that other store is, I don't go there.
Yeah.
You know, would stop selling guns, then there would be this there would be the beginning of a cultural shift around guns and why we need them and why we don't need them.
And let's remember that we're having a Democratic primary in this country, and the Democrats are certainly leaning, if not there, with sensible gun controls. So
there's that word again, sensible.
That's important. Well, yeah, but because it is sensible.
But it's ill-defined. In other words, it means different thing to Jerry Nadler, to Alan Chartok. Sensible is just a buzzword. It doesn't mean anything.
No, it means a lot. It means a lot. It means that sensible to me means you check when somebody wants to buy a gun whether they should be buying a gun. You know, to me, that's sensible. And, you know, there may be some room between these various proposals that people have. But we all know that there is a move in this country to put some kind of restrictions on gun sales.
Yeah, I think sensible is a buzzword for broad-based bipartisan support. And everybody's trying to figure out what that is. And since Congress isn't in session, they rely on the news to communicate with one another.
Well, the email address here is panel@wamc.org, and thank you for the great letters. There's still a little time if you want to weigh in here. Olympic fencing medalist Race Imboden took a knee in protest during his team's foil medal ceremony at the Pan American Games over the weekend. The American knelt during the national anthem at the medal ceremony, I think it was Friday, to protest racial and social injustice. He won a bronze in the individual men's foil event, took the gold in the team competition. And he said, "This week, I am honored to represent Team USA in the Pan Am Games, taking home gold and bronze." This was on Twitter. "My pride, however, has been cut short by the multiple shortcomings of the country I hold so dear to my heart: racism, gun control, mistreatment of immigrants." Sarah.
So this was the story that I was alluding to earlier when we were trying to thread the needle of protest, government crackdown, and race in America, democracy in China. I struggle with this a lot because I don't understand how kneeling for the national anthem becomes equated with a form of violence, with a form of anti-patriotism, which is just contrary to the founding of our country. I mean, Alexander Hamilton would have kneeled for for the Constitution that he believed in. And it troubles me when, especially on the anniversary of what happened in Charlottesville, where the president of the United States said that there were good people on both sides, when there clearly weren't. There were good people with signs, and there were Nazis.
Right. There is a big difference between the two.
Right. And that's not, you know, that's not what we're talking about with this specific form of protest, except it is. It's all related. People are taking a knee to combat that sort of the racial division in our country, which is connected to the immigration, anti-immigrant sentiment, which has its roots in racism, and it's all interconnected. And these athletes are using their literal podium when they have it to make a statement because they know that that's the only time that people are going to listen to them. When's the last time you followed fencing?
Yeah. This is true.
Or hammer throwing, which is the other athlete who raised a fist during the national anthem, a woman, a black
woman. And
Carlos
just died, the guy who did it
In the
Olympics. He just died. But then on the flip of this, you have in Montana a 39-year-old man has been charged with felony assault of a minor because he slammed this kid into the ground, right, for not taking his hat off during the national anthem. And the kid is, you know, in really bad shape. He's got, he fractured his skull because
of this. And one can only think about what's going on in China, you know, in Hong Kong. So now you have people who are willing to risk their lives by making this protest compared to what's happening, you know, and for one guy taking a knee. It's unbelievable.
And now we have the headline that just came out because this is breaking news. To curb immigration, this is from the Times, the Trump administration will target legal migrants who use public programs such as food stamps, housing, and subsidies. These are people who are here legally.
Yeah, that's
you know, this is absolute racism. This is Nazi Germany. This is rounding people up because you don't like the way they look, you don't like the way they speak, and they're not white. This is, you know, Stephen Cohen, right? Stephen Miller at his best.
And the New York Times says that Trump is going to win the election or could well win the election.
Well, you know, there are people who are so afraid that they're no longer going to be in the minority that they want to round up as many people of color as possible. They would round up citizens.
You mean to no longer be in the majority?
Right, right. They would round up citizens and ship them back to Africa if they could so that they could maintain their majority status.
We have detained citizens. There was one. There have been several citizens detained. Some of them are military veterans that have been held in detention for weeks at a time.
And a woman who was married to a vet who's been in this country for years is being sent back to her to Mexico. I mean, it's insane what they're doing.
So protest,
right.
and how we talk about it. It's the disproportionate use of force. By governments cracking down on peaceful protesters or even protesters that are maybe not as peaceful, but are strategically, you know, blocking entrances or doing things that might cause a quote unquote public safety risk in order to make the point. How else are we supposed to be heard?
Well, the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, the vice president of communications, said every athlete competing in the 2019 Pan American Games commits to terms of eligibility, including to refrain from demonstrations that are political in nature. In this case, race did not adhere to the commitment he made to the organization committee and the USOPC.
So he's taking on a personal risk that he has worked his whole life. Hours and hours of practice, sacrificed all of this to get to that stage. And he loves his country so much that he's willing to risk the medal that he would earn as a result of all that hard effort in order to make our country better. And how is that not a patriot? I don't understand. I hope we get lots and lots of letters on this point, because I've spoken to people on the left who feel very strongly about anti, you know, about against protesters. And, you know, I went to a roundtable with Congressman Delgado a couple of weeks ago, and people were really upset about his vote on the border wall funding. And his point was it was an appropriations vote. Their money was needed to be sent to the border. I went to the border. It was desperate. And he raised an important point, which was look outside. There are people are going about their daily business. People are going to the post office. It's mm-hmm. tomato season, right? Like people are going to festivals. Nobody's in the streets. Nobody's yelling about this. Nobody, you know, not nobody. I shouldn't say nobody. There are lots
but
of
there aren't
hardworking
mass,
people. There
right.
isn't a mass
right.
effort in that district and anywhere else in New York recently that I can remember, except for in the city. There are regular mm-hmm. mass gatherings, but no statewide gathering to say stop it. Mm-hmm. Because we judge protest harshly. And all the people with the power maintain their power.
What do you mean we judge protest harshly? You don't, right?
No, I'm a big fan.
And I work so with, when you say we, what are you talking about?
Work with, as Americans, and I don't get it.
Well,
I
you're
don't,
an American.
Yep.
So not all of Americans do that. Right?
No, but enough do to keep people home, or to at least make people worry about coming out and making a statement. So I applaud these people that do it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, putting this back to the Hong Kong context for a second, right? If you look at the number of people who've been involved in the protests in Hong Kong and scaled that up to the United States, that would be the equivalent of 70 million people
right. yeah.
showing
See,
up.
See, that's the thing.
And that would change elections. Right. I mean, just that many people going to vote would change right. would change our country.
Right. You know, these are small. I mean, Puerto Rico, Hong Kong, they're small geographic areas. Lots of people coming out. It makes visually you see what you see. You have the same amount of people who are coming out in Hong Kong coming out in New York. It might not be as visually massive.
But you know, I was there in D.C. in the Vietnam days, mm-hmm. and dating myself, but Earth Days, things like that. When you had 200,000, 300,000 people on the Mall, it makes a point. It's even more people than went to the Trump inauguration. I mean, it really makes a point.
But does it affect immediate change?
Immediate, no. But you know, I think the sustained protest, I think it changed thinking in America. I think we really did see
yes.
change. But of course, there was such a proximal thing, the Vietnam War,
right.
that could be focused on. I think it's much harder when you're arguing against things like economic inequality and treatment of people and mm-hmm. things like that, which don't affect our day-to-day life. You know, most days I go to work, I don't think about this stuff because I'm dealing with whatever.
Except
it's
on Mondays
going on
when
that
you're
day,
here.
Except for Mondays when I'm here, where thank God I got a chance to think about this stuff.
Alan, you want to get a word in here before we wrap up?
No, I think there are real reasons for people to be involved other than economic inequality, which I think is terribly important. But I think we have basically a madman as president,
mm-hmm.
And he keeps showing that day after day after day. That's the reason to get involved right now. This is scary stuff. This is Mussolini.
Well, and I think it's also worth getting involved to help people. You know, I've recently joined the boards of a couple nonprofits. I spend a lot of time trying to help out here in Albany, something called the Trinity Alliance, because, again, it's just we have to help people. If the government's not going to, we must step in. I truly admire what Sarah does in terms of immigration and things like that. I mean, it's really crucial that people get involved because that's the only countervailing mm-hmm. force.
All right, we need to wrap it up here. I want to thank the entire panel. Jim Hendler from RPI, thank you. Sarah Rogerson from Albany Law, thank you. Libby Post, thank you for being here. Alan Shartok.
I'm from somewhere.
You're a political consultant at large, right? Thank you all for being here. Thank you for listening. There is much more ahead on the roundtable. I encourage you to stand by for more exciting entertainment and information. You are listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.